This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 12th of August 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 96th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're not going to hit you with a theme this week, listeners. Instead, we're going to let you hear what we have up our sleeve and see what sort of garment that sleeve seems to fit. Monocle readers, though, will notice that we've doubled up a bit. We've done in audio here what you'll find in prose on the pages of Monocle's September issue, out now. Here, then, is that sleeve shaken out for show. I'll speak to celebrated novelist Adam Thirlwell about a new book of which he is the editor. It's Literary Chinese Whispers. It's all about getting lost in translation. It's called Multiples.
After about three of these mutations, someone along the line, their language abilities had so kind of got it all wrong that in fact the basic plot line of this, what was a rather harshly arid story about a love affair that never happens, that apparently suddenly by the end of this story now, they actually got together.
Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield brings us a zombified dispatch from Havana, a chat with the director of indigenous horror movie Juan of the Dead.
I knew the audience was going to like it. Most of the situations in the film are taken from real life, even the most crazy ones.
Just with extra zombies.
Yeah, I just added zombies to the mix.
Plus, we'll be tuning in to the ABTA TV conference in São Paulo, meeting the entrepreneurs breathing some life into Vancouver's independent bookstore scene, and picking our jaws off the floor to enjoy a quite beautiful and haunting live Midori House session from Alayla Diane, performing tracks from her new record, About Farewell. That's all coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Music first, of course. From Portland, Oregon, comes Alayla Diane. We'll hear from her in conversation with Andrew Muller later on in the show, but to kick things off, here she is, live for us last week with Lost Land.
The sleeper knows no lie. While the waker hides behind yellow curtains in the morning, heavy drapes upon my mind. Am I in too deep? Am I in too deep too soon? On the turn of a dime, with the wind on a chime, I'm a lost land in the blue. I'm a lost land in the blue. I'm a lost land in the blue. Some things are best if kept in darkness, only true before the dawn. A ghost ship, silent, deathly still, before the cannon storm. Am I in too deep? Am I in too deep too soon? On the turn of a dime, with the wind on a chime, I'm a lost land in the blue. I'm a lost land in the blue. I'm a lost land in the blue. I am walking on the shore. I am walking neath the ocean blue. I am walking sometime, somewhere. It is beautiful, like a lost land in the blue. Like a land in the blue, like a lost land in the blue, like a lost land in the blue. Thank you.
That was Alayla Diane with Lost Land, and we'll have a bit more from her later on in the show. Now to an intriguing literary exercise. Chinese Whispers is a playground or a parlour game favourite, but what happens when you play the game with short stories across languages as disparate as Japanese, Arabic and Hungarian, and put all these stories, now shaggy dogs, the lot of them, into a book? The answer is you get multiples, the idea of the celebrated young British novelist Adam Thirlwell. Thirlwell has edited and attempted vainly, it has to be said, to control an intense game of Chinese Whispers that brings in fascinating questions on language, the exactitude and opening for ego in translation, and the joys of jarring mistakes and routes travelled by accident. Featuring a cast list of authors including J.M. Coetzee, A.S. Byatt, Zadie Smith and Thirlwell himself, the stakes were high and the writing peerless. Thirlwell swung by to shed some light on this unique literary game.
So what it is a series of stories, 12 stories in all, which each undergo generally up to about 5 or 6 transmutations into other languages. And the kind of catch is that whereas normally your normal model of translation would be obviously that you're dealing with the original. Uh-huh. In this case, only the first translator in every series was working with the original French or Russian or whatever. Mm-hmm. And everybody else was working from a translation of a translation or a translation of a translation of a translation and so on. So that very quickly the original story gets kind of lost. And so really, I think it was a game with two things. It was really to say, you know, I'm a novelist, and in literature it's so often said that translation is kind of a nightmare, and that basically all these truisms of poetry is what gets lost in translation. Yeah.
And you say in the introduction to the book, and this is a book that we say you've edited, one of the story, you have the last story, the last word, as
the
it
last
were.
Word, yeah.
But you edit all the stories and presumably put a lot of these authors in touch and with a sort of demented magus behind the whole thing, in a good way, you're making... You should see his face. But in the introduction, you do talk about that, about the problems of translation and how the style gets across, whether or not you should be, I guess is the question, whether or not you should be entirely faithful to the words that they're reproduced or try and give a sense of the vibe of the piece.
Yeah,
and presumably your job is to do both.
Yeah, and I think it was the kind of vibe aspect that I was interested in, that obviously there were always going to be kind of problems of literal, like word-for-word problems of every language partly has some words that are just untranslatable, or there will be... especially in novel writing, there'll be kind of stylistic things that a writer is going to do that are just not going to work. Like you're not going to find the right alliteration in the new sentence in the new language. But what the sort of game was to say, given that basically everything gets lost in translation in one sense, why is it that in our everyday lives and when we're reading, we're entirely happy with this notion that it's not like when you read the Penguin classic of Tolstoy, you're kind of fretting that you're not reading the original Russian. And so really, I kind of wanted to prove that our intuition was correct, that actually... you could have an optimistic kind of book about translation or an optimistic book of translations. And where even things that we sort of think of as aesthetically sacrosanct, like style and form, mm-hmm. actually that kind of thing would still come across. And so I think I quite like your word vibe. It was this idea that somehow the tone or something would weirdly survive. And I think in most cases it did. I think I say in the introduction that definitely there were some unnamed series where I think the entire experiment was proved wrong. And it was an experiment. So that was the thing, that I had no idea. I certainly wasn't intending to do it at such length. And it was partly just because so many authors that I'd get in touch with or got in touch with me would be wanting to take
Everyone
part.
Liked the idea and wanted to be part of it.
And so suddenly this thing grew from this tiny project into this much more elongated one. So some of them it didn't work. But most of the time, I think, you know, I was quite happy with the results.
And the results are sort of entertaining. Some writers seem to have fretted about, as you say, maybe the sacrosanctity of the words that were handed to them and wanted to do that literal thing. But some of them, as you say, we talked about the word vibe, kind of wanted to more sort of riff on things and give it a bit of pizzazz and lift it and know that they were faking it. But wanted to make it readable, which is the thing. Another thing you say in the introduction is that you believe that style is the basic unit of literature, which is a really interesting thing. It's about getting the sense across, but with a readability. Is that what you mean by that?
I think what I meant was, obviously, in one sense, when you're reading, what you're really reading is the subject. You're reading for the plot or the kind of the characters. But that kind of, overall, in sort of the history of literature, to put it crazily grandly, what you in the end really want is someone to just invent a new way of talking in some way. That's what deep down you remember, is the crazy formal experiments of Lawrence Stern or of Tolstoy or of Flaubert. Like, they've not just invented amazing stories, but they've invented new ways of telling them. So we did deliberately choose stories where possible that were kind of partly slightly unknown and from kind of maybe European languages no one had heard of, and where they were doing something strange with the story as a form. I think also it was this idea that therefore deep down you could actually kind of lose the plot quite literally. So one of the stories that actually I think works brilliantly starts with, the first translation is by Lydia Davis, who's a fantastic American writer, very known for her fierce precision, both in her own writing and in her translations. So when she wrote me a very sort of correct and stern email saying, I'm very happy to take part, but it will be a very faithful translation. I'm not going to be doing any of your kind of shenanigans that you seem to be wanting. And then what happened was it kind of went in and out of French and English and back again. And so I suddenly realized that after about three of these mutations, someone along the line, their language abilities had so kind of got it all wrong that in fact the basic plot line of this, what was a rather harshly sort of arid story about a love affair that never happens, that apparently suddenly by the end of this story now, they actually got together. They were kind of, but weirdly, like this kind of the nostalgic tone was still there. So like something had somehow kind of gone through.
I wonder whether you feel that the job of a translator is to subsume their own ego in order to facilitate the pitch and story of the prose they get in the first place.
Yeah.
Is that the job to be egoless?
Of a really good translator. Yeah. And I think one of the things I was playing with in this project as well was thinking, I was trying to imagine it with some of these stories as they came in. If I were the original writer of this particular story, would I be happy looking at this mutation number five that in one sense bore no relation whatsoever to my original? Would I really be happy if someone published that as a translation of my text? And I have to admit that in some ways, definitely, I would be absolutely horrified. But I think what I was interested in was this idea of why can't you take more liberties? And it's interesting you're talking about ego lists, because actually I deliberately excluded actual professional translators. So one of the amusements for me was, you know, knowing friends who were writers who had never in their lives considered doing a translation before and who thought they could barely speak another language. One of the fun kind of aspects for me was then persuading them, yeah, you can speak Italian well enough. I think you should do this. And then watching whether they were so not wedded to their style sounds too kind of egotistic of them. What I mean is just if you've spent your life kind of developing a manner of writing, like kind of honing your voice, how easy is it for a novelist to then suddenly think, oh, okay, but this novel this story I'm translating is in a completely different voice, so can I kind of mimic that? Being translated is a very strange thing, and partly I wanted to do this because I think poets and kind of playwrights get that they're just used to their stuff that's going to be adapted or there's going to be a version of, and they kind of, as a novelist, you have this weird luxury that you pretty much assume it's going to be as faithful word for word as possible, that people would be quite horrified if it turned out that the new novel by Michel Houellebecq actually had dropped a couple of chapters and the translator had added their own chapter kind of at the end or...
Yeah.
And evidently, like, deep down, that's what you want. But I think what I was interested in was, what if, you know, could there be an extra space where we could play around a bit more and kind of imagine what are the real parameters of this? Because I think, especially of fiction, the parameters are slightly too strict. I sort of feel it's such a strange object that we've produced because you can't really read it all through as if it's some anthology of short stories. For one reason is that in all there are 17 languages in this book. So unless there is some extraordinary polymath out there.
Yeah, I want to see that.
There is no one reader, I think, who's going to be able to read the whole book. And I quite like that there's a sort of chance element that each reader's experience will basically be different and just depend on what other languages they've picked up or what they try and read.
That was Adam Thirlwell, and his book Multiples is out now, published by Granter. For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. The 2013 ABTA Television Fair and Conference just wrapped in São Paulo, where industry leaders in the TV market gathered to discuss opportunities in the growing Brazilian market and beyond the country's borders and throughout the rest of Latin America. It was the largest fair for the pay TV and broadband market in Latin America, and with subscription TV growing at an annual rate of about 20%, many have a keen eye on Brazil. Monocle correspondent Sheena Rossiter was at ABTA 2013 to see the innovative thinking and technologies in Brazilian TV that set this market apart from the rest.
The walls at the Transamericana Expo Center in Sao Paulo's South Zone echo with excitement and are buzzing with ideas. Around 8,000 visitors have come here for the three-day ABTA 2013 television conference to discuss the next big things in Brazil's pay TV market. TV has been a cornerstone of Brazilian culture with its Sunday night football and variety shows and its traditional telenovelas. Actually, TV is so important to Brazilians that there are more television sets than there are refrigerators in the country, according to the 2010 IBG census. Alexander Annenberg, the former president of the Brazilian Pay TV Association and now a consultant, explains why television plays such a big role in Brazilian culture.
It's very important. Most people are not accustomed to read very much. In this sense, television has occupied a very important place in the transmission of information and culture, maybe because of this lack of reading.
Do mesmo jeito, embora seja uma plataforma diferente.
And the Brazilian audiovisual industry just got an added boost. In June, a new law was passed allowing for the government to provide more funding and added training for productions to Brazilian pay TV channels.
Tem mais festivais fora do Brasil, tem mais encontros desse tipo, mas principalmente.
Brazil's Minister of Culture, Marta Suplicy, spoke to a wall-to-wall crowd at the ABTA 2013 opening panel. Bursting with pride, she praised Brazilian filmmakers for boosting Brazil's soft power image through locally made productions. We are making advances and producing more here in Brazil, she says. But the only people who can make that happen are you. Good luck. Alexander Annenberg is also proud about Brazil's progress in the audiovisual industries.
The most important thing to me is the birth of national channels, Brazilian channels. I didn't expect that we would have so many Brazilian channels, very, very nice Brazilian channels. And I think we have here a blend of international and Brazilian channels, which is very significant, very important.
Matou sua mãe, Frei Santiago. Posso me retirar dele, né?
In recent years, the pay TV and the entire audiovisual sector have undergone expansive changes, to say the least. Instead of your usual A to B form of broadcasting to consumption, viewing habits are more varied and dynamic now, more than ever.
I think TV today is trying to figure out what is the TV in the future.
And sitting at the center of all this are people like Terry Martin, the executive director of Negravision in Brazil, a service provider for pay TV operators.
11 years ago, the pay TV market was 3.5 million subscribers. Today it is over 17 million subscribers. So all this explosion that's mostly happened in the last 6 years has a very strong dynamic, a very strong momentum. I think Brazil has become a very innovative place for TV. Competition has been ramping up. People, a lot of people and homes in Brazil have been discovering what pay TV and digital TV is in the last few years. So I think this momentum is likely to carry more. So I think it's likely to follow that trend.
The main challenges facing TV companies in Brazil is a continental-sized country plagued with poor infrastructure. Needless to say, there is plenty of work to do in that area.
Carol, ele faz as coreografias e todo mundo quer copiar.
As in the developed world, what's serving as a bigger threat is the rise of free online video platforms like YouTube. Globosat, the pay TV programmer of Globo, Brazil's biggest network and the second biggest in the world, is innovating fast. Gustavo Ramos is their new media director.
We're obviously sort of under attack by all these new entrants. We have two options. We try to charge for our services, be it transaction-based model or a subscription-based model, or we can give it for free. We tried some of those models. We actually have a subscription transaction VOD type models, but it seems like we can separate or set aside a little bit of our revenues and devote that to innovation. And so the whole theme was around, we should right now innovate, and try to just basically protect our business model from all the new entrants. And we have the funds for that.
Terry Martin, again.
We don't think at Nagra that we have the answer to all that, but we think our duty is to bring technology to make that answer possible. So we think operators will come up with the answer, or somebody will come up with the answer. And the answer will probably be like TV normally is, very regional. Every region has its own way to go about TV. And if there's one thing we learn on the market, it's that.
What ABTA 2013 showed was not only the importance of television to Brazilian culture, but that Brazil is willing to innovate at a time where the market is undergoing drastic changes. So for now, it's clear that television will stay alive and well in Brazil, no matter what form it's in. For Monocle, in Sao Paulo, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thank you, Sheena. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're back after this to meet the man behind Cuba's first zombie movie.
Surf's Up this summer as Monocle Films follows the wind in search of an under-the-radar beach haven for diehard enthusiasts.
Ericeira is special for its wide array of waves, beach breaks, point breaks, and reef breaks to suit a range of surfing styles and skill levels, all in a compact span of dramatic coastline. This 8-kilometer stretch of coast was named a World Surfing Reserve in 2011, and the surfers who come here can't stop raving about it.
Catch the wave in Ericeira in the film's menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, where we're off to Havana. Yes, we're familiar with the Cuban capital as a place of noble rot, of beautiful colonial buildings falling into photogenic, artistic disrepair. But what if the same happened to the locals? What if Havana became a zombie capital, peopled by the undead, the flesh-eating, the downright terrifying? Well, then we'd be in the universe created by Alejandro Brugues, director of Juan of the Dead, shot on location in Havana. Steve Bloomfield went to Cuba and had the frighteners put on him.
I've always liked zombie films, and one day I was with one of my producers here, and I saw people in the street that looked like zombies, and I told him, I just told him we could make a zombie film using people like them, and we wouldn't even need makeup, and we can call it Juan of the Dead. and then I looked at him and I said, you know what, that's the next one. And I started to work on that. I mean, it was I just made that joke, and I had a main character, a theme. I knew it would have social commentary and all that. And so what I did after that was I spent like a year working on the screenplay, looking at the Cuban society around me and trying to picture it in a zombie apocalypse. It was a very fun year.
And once you'd finished that script, if you want to get a film made here in Cuba, you have to present that script, don't you, to the government. Talk us through that process.
It depends on how you do things. In my case, because it was a very big film, much bigger than the films that you usually do here. Eventually we had to show them the screenplay, but first it was the problem of finding the money was we knew for a film of this size we wouldn't find it in Cuba, so it had to be a co-production. In our case it was with Spain, and we got to the point of showing the screenplay much later in the process.
They are zombies. They are the living dead.
And when you showed them the screenplay, what happened?
I think they laughed a lot, and I truly believe they thought that was so crazy that someone just said, let him try, he's never going to be able to do it, so give him what he says. And we did it. When you see the film, you'll understand what I'm talking about.
In the film, there are mentions of Castro, there's scenes in Revolution Square with hundreds of zombies. Were you worried about sort of the reaction that you might get when you showed it?
No, because I knew the audience was going to like it, the Cuban audience. Most of the situations in the film are taken from real life, even the most crazy ones.
Just with extra zombies?
Yeah, I just added zombies to the mix, and I took a lot of things from real life. And what I did, for example, you have to see it, it's Havana starts getting full of zombies. Zombies start overtaking Havana, and there's this man, Juan, and his friends, who set up a business, which is one of the things that Cubans do when things get bad, set up a business. One of the dead we kill, your beloved ones. If you had zombies at home, these are the guys you call to get rid of your problem. And what I wanted to explore was how Cubans react in front of problems. We usually do three things: keep going with our life as if nothing happened, or set up a business, as I just told you, or get on a raft and try to leave. You see all those stages in the film, but with zombies. I have an exodus with zombies.
Now, the film has been hugely successful all over the world. It began in Toronto at the film festival there. You end up winning a Goya in Spain. How has that success helped you in terms of trying to show the film here in Cuba?
We were lucky because the film started to make a lot of noise even before we shot the film. Before shooting the film, we had a very big for a Cuban film campaign at the Cannes Film Market, and it started to appear on different newspapers and all that. Then after Toronto, it went to many festivals, to the Fantastic Fest in Austin, to CGS. We went to Rio, it was crazy. It was like 10 festivals before coming to Havana, and it had already won some awards. And when it premiered at the Havana Film Festival, we still didn't know if there was going to be a distribution here. But well, when it premiered, the first screening of the film here in Havana, there were 15,000 people trying to get 15,000.
15,000.
15,000 trying to get into the theater. It was like a rock concert. There were 4 police trucks with dogs throwing maize on people's faces and all that, because it was like a demonstration. The people that were making lines for 8 hours and couldn't get in. And I remember some people were coming into the theater crying because the police had thrown pepper spray?
Pepper spray, yeah.
Pepper spray. And they would look at me and say, the film better be good. And I was so nervous. I got drunk during that screening. I had to buy a bottle of rum, and I was standing in the back of the theater drinking all the time because I could not stand that. And they liked it. And we won the audience award. The film has won 10 audience awards all over the world, which is nice. And they had to show it. They had to show it.
That was Alejandro Brugues talking to Steve Bloomfield. There's more from Alejandro in the new issue of Monocle magazine. If you'd like to see the film for yourself, visit juanofthedeadmovie.com. Still to come in part two, Alayla Diane will return with more of Portland's finest tunes. She's playing tracks from her new record about farewell. We'll meet the bibliophiles, bringing a breath of fresh air to Vancouver's independent bookstore scene. And we'll meet London-based musician and producer Mala to hear how he's been mixing his dubstep beats with Cuban classics. Those who've only ever read about Portland, Oregon, might assume its citizenry to be largely composed of introspective singer-songwriters with acoustic guitars. And they wouldn't be far wrong. It would be easy to lose Alayla Diane in the vast herds of gingham-clad strummers until you heard her sing. Diane's voice is an extraordinary thing, the more so for its understatement ranging from a Gillian Welchish croon to a Sandy Denny-esque trill. And it's never sounded better than on About Farewell, her fourth and best album. Musically and lyrically simpler and sparse than any of its predecessors, it chronicles the end of Diane's own marriage with considerable poise and a commendable absence of self-pity. Well, we'll find out more when we hear from Alayla speaking to Monocle's Andrew Miller, but before that, another track from her Midori House session. This is The Way We Fall.
It was back in my hometown, drinking whiskey from the bottle. It was an Indian summer, wildfires were burning. Didn't know was the last time. You never know when it's the last time. I didn't know it was the last time. Thank you. I walked miles after midnight to a filthy attic room. I can still evoke the stale smoke of his cigarettes, 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 cigarettes. I didn't know was the last time. You never know when it's the last time. I didn't know it was the last time. Tim was on the sidewalk with his empty ocean eyes. He was smiling like a shadow and would never age, never age, never age, never age, never age. I didn't know was the last time. You never know when it's the last time. I didn't know it was the last time. Summer past, the smoldering I do recall, the hopeless fate, the way we fall, the way we fall.
First of all, about Farewell, it's a noticeably sparser record than previous efforts. Was that an artistic decision or a logistical one?
Probably a bit of both. I think I just began recording the record and started with vocals and guitar. And the subject matter of the songs is intensely personal. And it didn't really feel like I wanted to be sharing it with everyone. So I think that the recording process started with primarily me and kind of continued mostly to be that way.
And obviously to keep it all as private as possible, you put it all on a record and then sent it out into the world and toured with it. But was that in itself a difficult thing to do? Because obviously a lot of times songwriters can hide behind a certain amount of artistic license and say, well, it's not really about this, it's actually about that. But this album, even if somebody didn't know the backstory, it's fairly unmistakable.
It is fairly unmistakable, and it is a bit nerve-wracking to do that, but I sort of just felt like I needed to, so I put it out there.
But when you were writing it for that reason, was there any amount, I guess, of second-guessing or self-censorship or thinking, oh, no one needs to know that, or I don't want to tell people that much?
Well, I think that I was writing these songs as really to get through something. All the songs are about my recent divorce, and writing the songs was sort of a cathartic thing that even made me realize I needed to leave my husband in the first place. And so I wasn't editing what I was saying, and it felt, you know, not possible to go back then and change things. That would be cheating, I think. So
did you surprise yourself at any point during the writing? While you were going through this stuff and writing about it, were there points at which things or thoughts popped up and you found yourself thinking, where did that come from?
Absolutely. I think in a lot of ways, these songs became sort of the messengers of what I was trying to tell myself, the messengers of my own truth. And because I wrote them all within a very brief period of time. And I remember sitting in my house and playing them, sort of hiding off in a corner, and realizing that I wasn't going to be able to perform these songs or release a record of any of them unless I followed through with what I was saying in the songs. And what I was saying was that I needed to separate from my husband and go through with it and get a divorce. And so I had the songs, and then I had to go through with the rest of it after that.
The domestic conversations could potentially be awkward if you didn't.
Exactly. Where did this song come from?
Has he in fact heard the album at this point?
He actually has, yeah. And he heard it only pretty recently, maybe a month or two ago. And I think it was maybe not the easiest thing for him to hear, but none of the information on the record was something that came as a surprise to him. So,
but it is quite a kind and forgiving record.
It is.
It's not one of those sort of breakup albums.
It's not lashing out.
It's not the oral equivalent of cutting all his suits up and sewing fish into the curtains.
Not. And we remain friends. And so I think that for that reason, he was able to listen to the album. So,
are you getting lots and lots and lots of long emails from people who want to tell you all about their divorces?
Fortunately, they don't have my email address. But I have had some people come up to me after concerts and just say, you said what I couldn't say myself, and things like that, which is really wonderful to hear because, I mean, I think that's why music and art can be so helpful to people, is because, you know, sometimes as a songwriter, you are able to say some things that are a bit shocking that you know, not anyone can just go around and say, so...
I remember years ago interviewing Ryan Adams, and it's still one of the most astute summaries of what a songwriter does I've ever heard. He just said every song is basically standing up in front of an audience and asking a question, which is, does anybody else feel like this?
It's true.
And is that a course you think you will follow now as a songwriter? I mean, I don't mean getting divorced repeatedly, so you can...
God. I'm not planning on that either.
you can make another record, but to continue to focus things as personally as that?
I mean, I think probably. I do think that, for me at least, it's very important to only write songs when the songs need to be written. And if, you know, if things go really amazingly from here on out, maybe I just won't have anything to say.
Well, you could just make a series of just unbearably happy records.
Unbearably happy music. Everyone loves to hear that, don't they?
That was Alayla Diane talking to Andrew Muller. Her new album, About Farewell, is out now across the world, and she's playing a few dates in the US in September. Just go to alayladiane.com for more details.
The Monocle app puts Monocle 24's pacey mix of current affairs, business, culture, and music in your pocket. Whether it's midnight in Marunouchi or sunrise in Sydney, tune in to our around-the-clock audio service live from Midori House. Or download and replay your favourite programmes using the Time Shift feature. Also at your fingertips, our complete global travel guide. Get all this and more on the go on the Monocle app.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. We're trotting off now to turn a few pages in Canada. We've forever been champions of independent bookstores here at Monocle, and especially on the Culture Show. And in Vancouver, a couple of bibliophiles have caught our eye, opening up a design-savvy store for a new breed of reader. Reporter Lucy Hislop found a cosy and theatrical welcome at the Paper Hound bookstore, where e-reader is a dirty word.
Oh, yes. Dr. Greenspan knew I had the obstruction, but he had to bring the cancer back under control before I could have surgery to open my intestines. Greenspan conferred with the doctors in Connecticut and decided to continue the chemo while giving me my nutrition through the IV.
Local singer Biff Naked is in full throttle as she delivers her favorite lines, albeit restricted to 5 minutes only, while surrounded by a dozen or so book aficionados. Billed as Vancouver's most casual, this is the inaugural weekly lunchtime reading series at the Paper Hound, a new downtown bookstore complete with a fetching logo that's the brainchild of co-owners Rod Clark and Kim Cook.
Welcome to the Paper Hound. We're here in our west aisle looking at the travel section right now, which is divided into Wanderlust,
Slipping off to the side to chat, she explains the appeal of returning to physical books in an age of e-readers.
We wanted to be a bookstore where you really had an experience of being in a bookstore, which seemed to be the important thing, that of a bookstore where you could go in and have that feeling of the serendipity of searching and making tangential associations between books and ideas and feeling surrounded by physical books and having that presence and that very visual experience.
Indeed, the Paper Hound is a visual experience writ large. Just below the boutique Victorian Hotel in a rare for Vancouver 19th century building, the intimate 700 square foot space is surrounded by neatly orchestrated floor-to-ceiling shelves and cleverly curated books displayed on Alexander Calder-esque stands made from wire hangers. An old medicine cabinet doubles as the section for books banned during their day, such as Salman Rushdie's The Satanic Verses, and old copies of newspapers decorate the walls. It's all ripe for those looking for something far, far away from our homogeneous world, as Clark explains.
The pendulum has swung the other way now, and there's an opening that wasn't there before, whereby, you know, a small shop with a little footprint can, well, it speaks to people, right? They realize now what's happened to the cultural landscape in most every city in North America. It's the same thing. It's just rolled across. And we've lost some of our little cultural nodes in the city that we used to have before. So it was kind of a no-brainer, to use that expression, because we're career booksellers. We've been doing this for a long time.
And it's a concept that has the younger generation intrigued with its Ars Amatoria and classic James Bond titles as much as the older one, according to Cook.
A lot of bookstores have really been struggling along for a long time in a real, that have been operated in the traditional bookstore manner. And so we have had at least the benefit, even though it's been sort of a heartbreaking benefit, of watching all the problems that they've had to go through and trying to imagine how a bookstore can be different and can be relevant in the post-Amazon era. In the old bookstore where Rod and I used to work, which is just down the street from here, which is an amazing bookstore called McLeod's, and it's very, very visually overwhelming. There's just piles everywhere, and it's really fantastic. It's a rabbit's warren. And younger people would come in, and they'd say, oh, it's like Harry Potter. And that was their, like, that was the closest experience that they could relate to this place, was Harry Potter. And I think it's because there's a deficit of interesting, eccentric spaces in Vancouver. And that's what that store provided. And so we wanted to give a similar kind of experience here.
From Booze and Beatnik to Rants and Gories, that being Edward, not horror, Clark sees wittily labeling the sections as a way of standing out.
It's that thing where people really respond to a different narrative, a different way of classifying things. So instead of history, you might have autocrats and aristocrats and warfare and plunder instead of military history. And you can break down a lot of the kids' books that way too, Indomitable Orphans or The Rodent as Hero, books about bears. And there's whole categories like that that are, they're just a lot, it's just a lot more fun to put a book under that rubric rather than simply calling it history or literature or fiction or, you know, philosophy.
We go a little bit further. We've got Crime and Cunning, our section for detectives, and The Canadian Lawyer, Crime's Nemesis, Minute.
The Paper Hound is even giving some love for the ephemera, such as old bookmarks, photos, and even a check, often found inside tomes. Usually discarded, the pair has all of it displayed on a couple of racks as part of what Clark calls the book's history.
Yeah, it's just another way of establishing a kind of a provenance for the book and a story behind, you know, where it came from. And writing in books just doesn't bother me as much as it used to. It's still annoying to see egregious underlining of every second sentence. But then again, that seems to have its place too, because we're selling books outside that are, as we've got in the sign there, $1 books, books with issues.
As Naked finishes her reading, people are clapping before returning to browse the shelves and laugh at its erudite titles. The Paper Hound might have its roots in an old concept, but even in their heyday, bookstores were never this entertaining. For Monocle, in Vancouver, I'm Lucy Hislop.
And if you're in Vancouver and want to pop into Paper Hound, you'll find it at 344 West Appender Street. Paperhound.tumblr.com has all the details. London musician and producer Marla is playing festival dates across Europe this month. His Marla in Cuba live show has seen him successfully pair dubstep-style dance music, of which he is an originator of the sound, with contributions from traditional Cuban musicians such as jazz pianist Roberto Fonseca, gathered while on a trip there in 2011. Marla took time out from his tour to stop by Monocle 24 Studios recently to tell Tom Hall all about it.
Since 2004, you know, we've been releasing records on our own label, and we didn't call it anything at the time, you know. It was just the type of music we were making, and then people start saying, oh, this is dubstep, and this, the, you know, people start throwing around all these different names and stuff, and, you know, we just kept making music, and years down the line, we've seen it grow, and come 2006 or something, we start getting interest of bookings abroad, and I think in 2007 was my first tour in Japan and New Zealand, and taking the music out that side of the world. And just slowly but surely, you know, we've just seemed to keep expanding and keep growing and keep enjoying making music, and which led me to, you know, obviously 2010, and, you know, Giles had been down to DMZ on numerous occasions over the years, and I'd been invited to go and do some radio shows with him. And yeah, it was just a random November, and Joe said, you know, I'm doing a project in Cuba, in Havana, with Havana Cultura. I want you to come along and make an album.
And what kind of musicians are we finding on that album? What's the sort of cast list? Are these kind of famous in Cuba, or are they, you know, people that you met? Or
like, yeah, if you Google Roberto Fonseca, you'll see that he's a very established musician in his world, played with Buena Vista Social Club. Him and his band, they've been playing music together for 15 years. So for me, it was a very, very daunting experience to be in a room with such incredible musicians, and where they play music traditionally and classically. You know, I don't come from that school. I come from a very abstract trail of thought when it comes to making music. I'm from a Nintendo generation. I sit down in front of a computer and press buttons for hours. That was my way into making music. It was Nintendo. You get what I'm saying? So it was very different worlds, but at the same time, they were very warm and very, very welcoming, and they were very giving. You know, so they made me feel very, very comfortable, despite feeling very uncomfortable. Muevo mis recuerdos, viajo con la mente, salgo del encierro, analizo donde piso, calculo los movimientos y a veces do re mi fa sol. La noche se despierta en sobornar hasta de manera normal tu control. Tiene la llave maestra para sobornar y a veces te dejo una desilusión.
Is there a strong, like, dance music scene out in Cuba?
Mostly house and kind of like trance, electro and reggaeton is very, very, very big in Cuba. But, you know, they don't have the same kind of like subcultures of electronic music that we have here in London, or say other major cities like New York or LA, or, you know, even other major cities here in England. So in that respect, it's quite closed. The internet speed there is very, very slow. For them to download, say, like a 128 3-minute MP3, it would take them, that's providing the system doesn't crash out.
Right.
It would probably be from like 7 or 8 p.m. in the evening to like 9 or 11 a.m. the next day.
Oh, my God.
So giving your music to people there is probably the safest place in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not going to upload it and share it like that. You know, it will be a real underground thing.
Yeah.
It's a word of mouth thing. It's a thing where people come out and experience it, you know. And that's why, you know, me and Giles played at a party there when we was out in Cuba the year before. And about 100 people turned up at this house party. When I played last year in this kind of pavilion, 2,000 or so people turned up to come here. Because they were saying, you know, the word spread out that this guy from London playing this dubstep that was coming. So, and it's crazy to see that, because here people are lazy because of the internet now. Everyone's got everything. Everyone can have everything at click, click, click. But when you've got to go out of your yard and go and experience it, it brings a different kind of energy and a different excitement to the environment. So yeah, that was really a nice thing to experience.
That was London-based musician and producer Marla chatting to Tom Hall. That's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be exploring a new art foundation in Greece and taking an in-depth look at Seoul's publishing scene. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producers were Katie Bilbao and Holly Fisher. They are officially the Dream Team. And time for one final song this week, of course, from her beautiful Midori House session. Here's Alayla Diane with the title track of that great new LP, About Farewell. Thanks for tuning in.
It is plain to see that I have one foot out the door, and I know that your dear heart is telling you to run deep down somewhere, deep down somewhere. I heard somebody say that the brightest lights cast the biggest shadows. So, honey, I gotta let you go. Seven years to you, dear heart, is all that I can give. And I know that without me, you'll find just what you need. Deep down somewhere, deep down somewhere. I heard somebody say that the brightest lights cast the biggest shadows. So, honey, I gotta let you go. Leaving is the hardest part, that's what we've always said. But once upon the other side, it's best not to look back. That's what we say about farewell. That's what we say about farewell.
Thank you.